Let's take our Bibles, if you would, please, and turn to John chapter 6. Oftentimes, we're not opposed to believing in God. We're just opposed to believing in who God says He is. We'll find that to be the case today in John chapter 6. John chapter 6, the sermon's entitled this morning, Sovereignty Seizes the Moment. This is a unique moment in the ministry of Jesus. This is the high watermark of Jesus' ministry. This is the greatest momentum within Jesus' ministry. And it's a miracle that's recorded in all four of the Gospels, not just the Synoptics, but also in the book of John. So this is a significant event. It's a significant moment in the life and ministry of Jesus. John chapter 6, read verses 1 through 15. The Bible says in John chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, after this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain. There he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And lifting up his eyes, then he saw that a large crowd was coming toward him. And Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. And Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them, just to get a little." One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." And there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves. When he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up, and they filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who's come into the world." Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Well, all of us know the temptation that awaits at the entrance of the shopping market. Maybe you found it more of a temptation as a child, as mom was paying the bill, doing all the checkout, and you were standing there waiting as somebody was putting the stuff in the bag. But we see that shiny container filled with eye-catching trinkets that we just can't live without, right? I mean, now, maybe you're past that, but you remember when you couldn't live without the soccer ball there in the gumball machine. We all know the power that goes into putting that quarter in and turning it and getting what we want. Now, you might not have got the color that you wanted, but you got that thing. And you know that power of putting in that quarter, turning the little dial, and getting it. For one glorious moment, you know what it feels like to be sovereign. You are the king of your own little universe when you get what you want, right? It's a silly illustration. Let's up the ante a little bit. So we feel like a king, right? But soon you find out that there's better prizes available for those who have skill. So you don't just drop in the coin to get the thing. You drop in the coin to get the opportunity to win the thing, right? And so we put in the coin, and we try to wrangle that thing that we want from the clutches of chaos and that mangled heap from which it presents itself to us. We pay that price, and we try for that opportunity to try our hand at getting what we want. And again, we experience that endorphined glow of sovereignty, right? We are masters of the universe. We've gotten what we wanted most. This is the human condition. We feel that sovereignty. We feel that ability to control. We desire to exercise sovereignty or control as we navigate a world that's filled with chaos, filled with confusion, filled with limited resources, filled with an abundance of pain, abundance of suffering. It's in this condition of uncertainty and fear, of hurt and heroism, that makes us subtly vulnerable to the spiritual reality of idolatry. Now, we wouldn't necessarily, in this culture, bow down to something like this. But what is idolatry at its heart? Idolatry is simply finding something that has the power to give us what we want and the ability to manipulate it to our own advantage. Again, it's not that the idol itself is the sovereign, but it enables us to be sovereign as we manipulate the idol to get what we want. Again, we're a little more sophisticated than to make it this blatant. But the reality is that this is what each of us struggles with in our hearts. We want to be the masters of our own universe. We want to be the sovereign of our destinies. And that's a reality, that's the condition of humanity all the way back to the garden when Satan said, God has told you, you can't do something. You're going to let him be sovereign? Or are you going to take control of your own destiny? Are you going to take control of the thing that you want most? Are you going to grab life by the head and just take it for all that it's worth? And from that very moment, man has always been in the clutches of wanting to wrestle sovereignty from God and take sovereignty to ourselves. So this is essentially what's at stake in our text this morning. The people find in Jesus someone who's able to give them exactly what they want. And because of this, they want to take him and make him king so that they continue to use him to get what they want. Possible to make an idol out of God, to try to control the master of the universe so that we become sovereigns, getting what we want through him. That is, so they can be in control of their own circumstances, so they can be sovereign of their own security, so they can be masters of their own little universe. But as they find Jesus, as they find in him a power, they're going to find in him a power that refuses to be manipulated. In the And they find what we all must find, that Jesus will not be the king that you want him to be. Jesus will not be manipulated so that you can be the master of your own universe. Jesus will not be manipulated so that you can get the blessings that you want or feel that you deserve. Jesus is not that kind of king. Jesus is not that kind of king because Jesus is in fact king. And he will not let anyone share that glory. Jesus is king. And we find Jesus being king and Jesus wanting to be crowned king by the crowds as he spreads a table. And he spreads this banquet. In fact, it's just bread, it's just some fish, but there's more than enough for a crowd that numbers in the thousands. And as they take Jesus and they want to take him and use him to get more of what they want, we find Jesus at the end of this story walking away because he doesn't want to be a king that really still lets them be king. He wants to be the king that takes over their hearts and wrestles that sovereignty out of their clutch and enables them to let it go. Not that he takes it away, but they let it go. And he invites them to bow before his sovereignty, to trust him as the good shepherd, to do life with one who's benevolent in his sovereignty. So as we look at this text, what we're going to find is five movements by which this king is going to seize the moment in his sovereignty. As we get things set up, this is the Sea of Galilee. We're looking from the south up to the north. And we see, let's read the text here again, verse 1. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. So this west side is the side that was mostly occupied by Jews. This would be the far side, the Decapolis, and we've got more Gentiles living on that part. So when he says he went to the far side, He went to the side opposite the Jewish side. So he went over this direction. Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is also called the Sea of Tiberias. Well, you can see down here, there's the city called Tiberias. And Tiberias was the capital of King Herod Antipas. He named it Tiberias after his Roman patron, Caesar Tiberius, back in Rome. And this is the region that they're going. So it's on the opposite side. It's probably this area right down in here, just above Gergesa, just below the Golan Heights. It's kind of flat there. It's a place where several thousand could gather. And this is the region, just so you kind of have it geographically mapped out in your head. But as we come to this, this is the setting. And we're going to find that Jesus is going to set up this scene, or John's going to set up for us this scene, where the king is going to seize this moment in all of his sovereignty and walk away from their offer of kingship. What we find here is that this scene sets up some very important stuff for us, so don't miss what's happening. We talked just a little bit about where this is located, on the Sea of Tiberias. Interesting. Tiberias is the capital of a king, King Herod Antipas. He has his kingship because a bigger king has been his patron, has gotten him that place, that position. He's afforded him that authority. And so Herod Antipas tips his hand to Tiberius, who is the Caesar, the king. There's king marks all over this text as Jesus is going to be offered the position of king. He's going to walk away from this position of king, and he's going to do it as the king. So just keep in mind, there's a lot of different things that are happening. As this same miracle is set up for us in other places, Matthew calls this a desolate place, the Golan Heights. It's opposite where, on the left side of the Sea of Galilee, it's inhabited by all sorts of different villages. Magdala, Mary Magdalene, would have been on that west side. We have Capernaum up in the north. We have a few other different villages, but Tiberias would be especially the epicenter of population growth on that west side of the sea. He goes to a desolate place. So this is the setting where he's at. He goes there, Matthew says, to be alone, to withdraw, to get away from the crowd. Well, why? Because there's a specific timing in which this occurs. The timing is immediately after the death of John the Baptist. Matthew tells us that Jesus, having found out about the death of John the Baptist, says, you know what? I need to get away. I need to process. I need to spend some time alone with my Father. Because John the Baptist was the one, he was the forerunner of the Christ. He was the one who prepared the way. He was the one who was moving the obstacles out of the way so that people could recognize who Jesus is and repent and turn to faith as God sends his Son to be the Savior of the world. And John points him out and says, this is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. This is the Son of God. Don't follow me, follow him. He must increase, I must decrease. John's dead. Jesus has to get away and process it a little bit. It also says in the book of Luke that this immediately follows the ministry of the disciples. Jesus had taken his disciples, his 12 disciples, and he said, listen, all authority and power is given to me. I give you all authority and power to preach and to heal and to cast out demons. And they go, and they're gone for several weeks, and they come back. And in Luke 9, they tell Jesus, hey, thumbs up, successful ministry. This is awesome. We tell demons, get out, and they're gone. This is awesome, Jesus. This is great. We love it. Well, the success of their ministry begins to catch up with them. And the book of Mark tells us, right before this event, that they're so busy, they're hammered by so many requests for ministry, says they don't even have time to eat. They can't turn around with somebody else saying, hey, it's you! Hey, it's you! Hey, can you? Jesus says, hey, let's go to a quiet place. Let's just get away. We're going to unplug. We're going to turn off the cell phones. We're going to disconnect. We are going to get away. But the people see where he's going. And so they run around that north end of the lake, and they get there. And so we see in verse 2, a large crowd was following him. Well, why are they following him? They're following him because, it says, they saw the signs. Well, that's a good thing, right? I mean, Jesus is doing all of these works, and they're not just works to promote Jesus. They're works that are to show who Jesus is, and he's pointing them back to the Father. These are the works that the Father has given me to do. We spent 3 weeks looking at that in John chapter 5. These aren't my works. They don't point to me. I'm here to point you to him, to the Father. I have the authority of the Father. I have the power of the Father. But these works that I do, they're the works that the Father gave me to do. And so he's doing signs, and people are seeing the signs. They're reading the signs, and they're connecting with Jesus, and they're following Jesus because of the signs that he was doing on the sick. They're seeing that he has the power to step into the broken world and take the pieces and put them back together in a way where life makes sense again. Isn't that what we want? Don't we hurt when life hurts? When I got the call this week that my dad was going in the hospital because of appendicitis, I'm like, okay, that's bad. But hang in there, Dad. And then as I'm going to bed that night, my mom calls and she's in tears. And she says, I just want to let you know your dad's appendix burst before they got him into surgery. They're just taking him in now. All of a sudden, wow, brokenness becomes like serious broken. And we go to doctors, we go to nurses, we go to specialists because we want somebody who has the power to take the broken and put it together in a way that the broken works again, where life makes sense again, where we can keep going. And so it's not that they're wanting something that they shouldn't. Jesus is giving them not just what they want, but what they need. And they're recognizing their need. And this is a good thing, right? This comes as the disciples have been working so hard to put Jesus in front of people. Listen, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Jesus is the king. You've got to trust him. We're just his ambassadors. And they're starting to point Jesus, people to Jesus. And people are starting to buy into Jesus. More and more people are starting to buy into Jesus. And you can think as the disciples, 12 of them, you're riding the wave. This guy is going to glory. This is moving forward the way things are supposed to move forward. This comes at the high point of Jesus' ministry. And interesting, this takes place in the northern part of Israel, in that state or that region called Galilee. In chapter 5, we were down in Jerusalem. We were down in Judea. We were down in the epicenter of the culture of Israel. We were down with those who were learned in the law, the scribes, the scholars, the lawyers. We were down with the Pharisees. Here we're in Galilee. It's interesting that in Galilee, Jesus finds the high point, the zenith of his ministry. Why would that be? I like what Milne writes. He says, the Galileans were a distinct type. Peasants, living close to the soil, laboring hard for a subsistence wage. The primary issues for them are the down-to-earth matters of food, the means of livelihood. This is in contrast to the more sophisticated audience that Jesus encounters down in the south, whose concerns were more theoretical. You know what? It's easier to believe in Jesus when you believe that you aren't the answer to your own needs. And so God says he has made the poor of this world to be rich in faith, because it's so much easier to believe in Jesus when you actually believe you need Jesus. And so Jesus says, oh, how difficult it is for a rich man to get into heaven. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for one who doesn't need me to bow before me and call out in need upon me. And so this is the high point of Jesus' ministry. We come to verse 4. Let's go to verse 3. Jesus went up on the mountain. He sits down there with his disciples. He's going to catch a breather. And it gives us a little bit of a time setting. He has these little asides built into the text here, in this text in particular. Now, the Passover, the Feast of the Jews, was at hand. This narrative would read absolutely perfect, absolutely smooth if we went from verse 3. Jesus went up on the mountains. There he sat down with his disciples. Skip verse 4. And lifting up his eyes and seeing the large crowd that came to him, he does this. We don't need verse 4 there for the story to make sense. But we need verse 4 there for the story to make sense. He says, now, just so you know, the Passover, that is the Feast of the Jews, was at hand. That means it's spring. It's comparable to our Easter, right? Good Friday, we have the Lord's Supper, the Last Supper. Good Friday, when Jesus Christ is crucified. 3 days later, he rises from the dead. Passover is the time of Easter. Easter's in spring. So this is that beginning of the year, as far as the Jewish calendar is concerned. It's religious calendar. God said when he brought the Israelites out of Egypt, he said, I want to start this at the beginning of your year. I want you to take this time, and I want you to reorganize your entire calendar, because I'm doing a work right now that's going to reorient everything. I'm going to bring you out of Egypt so that I can bring you into the promised land. I'm going to bring you out of slavery so that I can bring you into blessing. I'm going to bring you out from under the hand of King Pharaoh so that you can be under the benevolent hand of King Yahweh. That's what I'm doing, and I want you to mark that now. So Passover is the beginning of what it means to be a Jew. D.A. Carson writes, he says, the Passover feast was to Palestinian Jews what the 4th of July is to Americans. He says, no, wait, it's bigger than that. We don't understand how much identity, national pride there is in this moment. Passover is what makes them Jews. No Passover, no Judaism. No 4th of July, no United States of America. So this is really big. But to enter into some of the feel of the largesse of this, I want us to listen to Colin Cruz. He says, this will be significant as the story unfolds. The Passover was a time when Jewish people recalled their deliverance from Egypt through Moses, and they were looking for a prophet like Moses who's yet to come. They expected this prophet to bring deliverance, just like Moses did, and to provide manna from heaven, just as Moses had done. It was when nationalistic fervor was high. All of these events are coming together in a perfect maelstrom. This isn't by accident. Jesus is coming to the zenith, the crux, at the very high point of his popularity. Things couldn't be set up better for him to take the reins and to take the throne. Everything is in position. All the stars are aligned. All he has to do is say, yes, that's all he has to say. Yes. One word, and everything changes. Now you get the feel for where we're at? Everything's in place for Jesus to become king. They're looking for it. They're wanting it. And what are they looking for? They're looking for deliverance. They're looking for a prophet, one who speaks from God, one who can do works of God. Jesus is the man. This is the setup. At this moment in particular, the people are looking for someone who will give them what they've always wanted. Right? Jesus is going to be the man. So this national identity that brings this messianic hope, that's the setting of what this all takes place. Now, secondly, we're going to see that the focus becomes limited in this story in verses 5 through 9. So lifting up his eyes, Jesus sees that a large crowd was coming toward him, and he turns to Philip and said, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Now, what we're going to find is that as the focus becomes limited here, that we're going to have kingdom ministry that highlights the deficiency of discipleship resources. Jesus is going to turn to Philip. Why Philip? Because Philip is from Bethsaida. Bethsaida is just a little farther up the coast from where they are just below the Golan Heights. Philip's from Bethsaida. He's a local boy. So Jesus turns to a local boy, one of his disciples, and says, "Now listen, where are we going to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Again, we look at the different stories. Luke 9 tells us that this has been hours that Jesus has been ministering to these people. He's been teaching them. He's been healing them. The evening's beginning to set in. So he asks this of Philip. And it says there, again, in another aside, verse 6, he said this to test him. For he himself knew what he would do. Again, you could read the story perfectly without verse 6 being there. He asked Philip, "Where are we to find bread so these people may eat?" Verse 7, so Philip answers him and says this. We don't need verse 6, but we absolutely need verse 6. Jesus said this because he wanted to test Philip. He wanted to find out what was in Philip's heart. He wanted to find out how Philip would respond to these people that are in need. Philip is one of the 12 who just went out. He's had successful ministry. He's been one who's been able to cast out demons. He's been one who's been able to heal sick people. He's been preaching the kingdom. He's had this foretaste of glory, power at his fingertips. Jesus says, "Hey, big guy. Hey, big shot. What should we do here?" So, real quick, I mean, you want Philip on your team. He's the bean counter. He's the mathematician. He's the accountant. He looks at the crowd. Philip answered him, verse 7. The way I see it, Jesus, 200 denarii. That's a denarii is one day's wage. This is about 8 months' worth of wages. 8 months' worth of wages wouldn't buy us enough bread so that everybody gets just a little. Jesus, I know economics. I know the region. I'm telling you, we could take 8 months' worth of wages and not, they wouldn't get a tidbit. They wouldn't get a mouthful. You're asking a stupid question, Jesus. He's not saying that, but basically he's saying, Jesus, that's kind of a stupid question. I've done the math. This isn't going to work. He fails the test. He fails the test because in front of him, the reality is so real. I mean, there's 5,000 just men. The other places tell us that there's women and children besides. Just men, it numbers 5,000. He asks this to test him, and he asks this in conjunction with a command to the disciples to feed them. Back in Luke chapter 9, verse 13, he says, "Why don't you guys give them something to eat?" that's funny, Jesus. Well, you've been out. You've been casting out demons. You've been doing this work. You're ministers of the kingdom. You guys give him something to eat. Is he for real? What's he getting at here? You kind of hear him poking each other. What's going on? This isn't fair. So Andrew steps up to the plate. Verse 8. One of the disciples, Andrew, this is Simon Peter's brother. He again is from the same region up by Bethsaida. And he says, "Hey, there's a boy here. A young man, he's just a little thing, kind of a runty fellow actually, but he's got a lunch. It's a little lunch, kind of small lunch actually. But there's five loaves, more like biscuits, small loaves, and fish, like sardines. But we got some. You get the idea? It's like, Jesus, we got something. You know what we got? We got a fish, and it was this big." At least Philip he says the math. Brrr. Jesus, if I take boom, it's not going to fit. Andrew comes up and says, "Yeah, I got..." What are you going to do with that? Okay, well, I mean, at least he's honest, right? This is what I got. And that's the whole point. Jesus is trying to bring these hotshots who are full of ministry, full of themselves to some degree in their ministry. He says, "Okay, guys, go ahead and feed them. What do you got? What do you got to feed them? If we took all our, maybe 200 denarii was all the money that Judas had in the bank. We don't know. Judas was the accountant. He was the money man. He was the treasurer for the group. Maybe Philip had been in touch with Judas and said, Jesus, all the money we have in the bag isn't going to feed these people. Andrew comes up and says, yeah, we got this. So this Jesus is trying to get them to do the inventory. This isn't really about the crowds at this point. This is about the disciples. Jesus makes it about the disciples. Andrew comes back. He says, we've got some barley loaves here. Biscuits, small. This, we wouldn't necessarily catch it unless we're very familiar with the Old Testament text. But back in the book of 2 Kings, a prophet was given 100 men to feed. And he had 20 loaves. And 20 loaves was too little for 100 men. Listen to the story as it plays out in 2 Kings chapter 4. A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God bread of the first fruits. He brought 20 loaves, loaves of barley. Barley is like the worst kind of bread. You would feed it to animals. It was not very digestible. It wasn't as good as the wheat. It didn't hold together as well. He brought 20 loaves of barley, some fresh ears of grain in his sack. And Elisha said, give it to the men that they may eat. And his servant said, how can I set this before 100 men? So Elisha repeated, give it to the men that they may eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left. So he set it before them, and they ate, and they had some left, according to the word of God. 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 42 through 44. Andrew says, hey, we got some barley loaves, prophet. What are you going to do with that? Note the emphasis. There's a large crowd. There's a small amount of food. Something's going to happen. He's got two fish. Okay, so we got this idea of bread. Moses brings him into the wilderness. They've got nothing to eat. What does God provide for his people? Bread, right? Manna, bread. Bread and quail. Quail, our natural habitat, is out there in the desert, the grasslands, the shrublands. Here we don't have bread and quail. Here we have bread and fish. So again, creatures made on day five of creation. You have those that are in the air, those that are in the sea. There's a similarity, but these are fish that he brings, probably pickled fish, somehow preserved there in the native setting. But we have a similar miracle to the Exodus, though, is what we're getting at. Jesus is living up to expectations. This is exciting. We've got bread, we've got fish, and Jesus wants them to understand, even if you take everything you've got nothing. And what you've got, which looks like nothing, why don't you give it to me? Why don't you give it to me? Verse 10. Jesus said, have the people sit down. Have the people sit down. Let's take what we've got. Again, I love what Bruce Milne writes. He says, we cannot simply amble along with Jesus, because Jesus is more concerned for our growth than he is for our comfort. To walk with Jesus means climbing. See, we have to find out that we're inadequate. That's the point. The situation demands Jesus. The situation demands the intervention of Jesus. The situation demands that you become small and he becomes great. That's the whole point. It's not until you realize that what you got is nothing that he can take the little nothing that you got and make something of it. But we're so often, we're quick to be Phillips, aren't we? Jesus, I got this. I got this. 200 denarii. Okay, at least they get a snack. No. Jesus, I got nothing. But what little I got, I give it to you. And that's what Jesus was trying to get his disciples to understand. He said, boys, you've been successful. Now let me show you what success looks like. Success looks like got nothing and giving it to God and watching God take your nothing and do something with it. So we come to the next place. We find that Jesus spreads the feast. He says, tell him to sit down. And again, a little aside. Now, there was much grass in the place. Wait a minute. They're in a desolate place. They're on the far side of the Sea of Galilee. But this is the time of spring. It's the only time that the grass would be growing there. And the grass, Mark says, is green at this point. Something's happening. They're on a flat place, the book of Matthew says. 5,000 just men. He has them sit down. And as they sit down, they're sitting on grass. Oh, wait a minute. Sit down. Jesus says, tell the people to sit down. The word is actually recline. What time is this? Now, the feast of the Passover was at hand. How did they eat the first Passover? Standing up. They had to have their belts on, their shoes on, their packs ready. They ate the Passover standing up. Jesus says, tell them to lie down. Tell them to lie down in green pastures. Oh. Do you hear echoes of the Old Testament coming in? This one is a shepherd king. He's telling his people to lie down in green pastures. He's going to prepare a table before them in the presence of their enemies. Right across the sea is Tiberias, where Herod, King Antipas, is on the throne, working against these people, working for the Romans, the dog. And Jesus, the good shepherd, is going to make them lie down in green pastures and prepare for them a table in the presence of their enemies. Go, Jesus! Right? He's preparing the feast. Have the people sit down. And the men sat down. Oh, wait a minute. You ever come to this story and it says there were 5,000 men? Oh, and besides women and children. What a chauvinistic text. Just concerned about the guys. Typical, right? This isn't the point. Look down at verse 15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, Jesus says no, and he walks away. When you gather all of these people and they want to make Jesus king, a king assembles what? To fight with him. An army. Okay? In the book of Numbers, they didn't count the women and children, not because the women and children weren't important, but because the women and children didn't make up the army. Okay? It's not looking over the women and children here. What it's doing is it's counting up the fighting men. He's got 5,000 men right now today that are going to lay down everything, walk away from families, houses, vocations, and say, Jesus, if you say yes, we're with you. You start to feel the intensity of this moment. All Jesus has to do is say yes, and they're with him. So they sit down. And Jesus took the loaves, and he gave thanks. I love this. I love the beauty of the humility of Jesus. He doesn't rip off big S in the middle of his chest. Super Jesus. Watch this. I'm going to tear this apart, and you're going to eat. He doesn't do that at all. He takes that bread, that little bit of bread. I'm going to leave this off. He's going to take that bread. I can imagine him holding it up so everybody can see. Folks, Chick-fil-A. Subway. Anybody hungry? Let's thank God. In public, he thanks the Lord. He said, blessed be the God, maker of the universe, the one who brings forth bread from the ground. He opens his eyes and he calls his disciples up. We're told in other passages that it's the disciples that actually bring it to everybody else. And so, naturally, everybody seeing him take the bread, break it, break it, break it, break it, break it, break it. Holy cow, how did he break that 12 times? Just 5 loaves. And the guys go off. And they start, break it, break it, break it. They pass it to one guy. He breaks it, breaks it, breaks it, break, break, break. Now listen to verse 11. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. And also the fish. Now don't miss that next line. As much as they wanted. Okay, they weren't Americans. They're Jews. All right. What happens in America? Something's free. You take as much as you need or a little bit more. Right? You with me? Okay. These aren't American, they're Jews. They got this down. This is highway robbery. Free! Today only! I'll take a couple extra. Now, wait a minute. God provides manna in the wilderness. What did God tell his people in the wilderness about the manna? Take as much as you want, but only take as much as you need. Because anything that you take above what you need is going to what? It's going to rot. It's going to spoil. Jesus comes in as a new Moses. He's going to provide for them manna in the wilderness. He's going to make them lie down on green pastures and prepare a table before them in the presence of their enemies. And he's going to start breaking the bread. He's performing this miracle. And they take as much as they want. They ate their fill, it says in verse 12. I like how one commentator said, nobody was left saying, you know, I think another piece of bread would be nice. I've got so much bread. I'm done. I'm full. That's it. What is Jesus highlighting at this point? He's highlighting that the kingdom, when it comes, you will rest in the abundance of God's good provision for his people. Does he want to be that kind of king? Absolutely. This is who he is. This is what he's come to do. This is who he has come to be. When Jesus is king, there will be plenty and you won't have to work for it. Go Jesus, right? Everybody's on Jesus' team at this point. Let's see how this continues to play out. He's going to drive it home now for us in verse 12. When they'd eaten their fill, no more bread, please. He told his disciples, go gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing's lost. Wait a minute, this is a different economy. In Moses' economy, you take what you need, nothing more, it's going to spoil. Jesus says, yeah, I know they took more than they needed. Go gather up the leftovers. I gave them not just what they needed, I give them everything that they could take. And they did. And Jesus sends out his disciples, and verse 13, so they gathered up, filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. Now, how many baskets do they fill? 12, right? How many disciples are there? That's not a trick question. There's 12. Okay. That means every disciple has a basket. Every basket came back full. Look at what it's filled with. You know what it's filled with, but don't miss that twice it says, verse 13, gather up the leftover fragments. And they filled 12 baskets with fragments. Here's what's going on. When Jesus brings kingdom to planet Earth and the brokenness of this planet Earth, he wants them to understand that the sufficiency of God always comes through the brokenness of his vessels. But when you allow God to take your nothing and to break it, he multiplies it. You know, I have a hard time giving God my little because I want it to be intact. And then he takes my little and he breaks it. And for crying out loud, what good is that? But in God's economy, it's only through brokenness that we find God's sufficiency. And he wanted every one of his disciples to have a basket in their hand so that this doesn't just become a theory in their heads like the Jews down south. He wants them to have the Galilean know-how. He wants them to have that taste and see that God is. He wants every one of his disciples to carry a basket in their hands that's filled with brokenness. He says, guys, remember what you started with. And remember that when you let God break it, there's more than when you started. They come back. Whoa. Unbelievable. Gather up the leftover fragments, and they filled 12 baskets. Now, we come to the end. And we find that Jesus is refusing to bow. Verse 14. When the people saw the sign that he had done, why are they chasing him in the first place? They're seeing signs. And now they get the sign of signs at the time when they're looking for the sign that looks like this. Another Moses. Provisions in the wilderness. A prophet that Moses said was going to come. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who's to come into the world." They're excited. All Jesus has to do is say yes. Verse 15, perceiving then they're about to come and take him by force to make him king. Let's rewind the clock just a couple of months before. Jesus is just starting his ministry. He's out in the wilderness, but this time he's by himself. He's confronted by that one who confronted Eve in the garden. And he sidles up alongside Jesus and he says, "Hey, Jesus, let me take you to a very high mountain and show you all the kingdoms of the world. Let me show you all their glory." And he said to him, "All these I will give you if you fall down and worship me." Jesus, you want to be king? Let's make this bargain. Jesus, I'll let you be king without a cross. I'll let you be king without any suffering. I'll give you all the glory and none of the brokenness that your Father calls you to embrace. And now such a moment has arrived. Jesus, why don't you be our king? No more brokenness. Jesus says, "My hour is not yet come. I came to be broken. And I came to be broken for you. And my brokenness will be sufficient, not just for the Jews, but for the Gentiles. Not just for Israel, but for the world. But my Father's kingdom only provides sufficiency through brokenness. And I am exhibit A. You cannot enter the kingdom. You cannot go to my Father unless I am broken in your place. Because, my friend, you're the broken one. Satan has taken you and he's broken you. He's made you to want to be the king of your own universe. He's broken you so that you can't find satisfaction in submission to a king who's benevolent and kind and sacrificial on your behalf. He's broken your perspective of God. He's broken your perspective of the lover of your soul. You're broken. You're a broken commodity. And Jesus says, "I want to heal you. I want to heal you. But if I become your king right now, I can't do that. Because the only way I can heal you is to be broken for you." So verse 15, Jesus withdrew to a mountain by himself. He's going to go pray. He's going to go talk to his Father. They're wanting to make Jesus king so they can get more of what they want. And Jesus says, "I can't be your king because I want to give you what you need." As he refuses to bow, he exercises the kingdom virtues of patience, that is God's timing, and faith, that is God's way. This is probably where we struggle the most. I'm impatient. I want things on my time. In fact, now. I'm pretty good now. Yesterday. Okay? I don't want to wait. Jesus says, "Not yet. It's coming. Not yet. How's this going to work? I'll make it happen. I'm My father's going to make this happen. I'm not going to pull strings. I'm not going to manipulate. I'm not going to coerce. I'm not going to do nothing. I'm not going to play on the emotional high of this group of people. I am going to wait, and I am going to watch the salvation that my Father provides for these people. What are our takeaway points in this? Three, I think. First is that in a broken world, the time is always ripe for a new king, right? At any point, you can drive by signs and yards and say, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, right? We're always ready for a new king. There's always brokenness. There's always going to be bungling in office. There's always going to be somebody who can do it better. That's life. That's life in this broken world. So you might think, well, maybe if we get the next guy in office is just going to be broken in the same ways that those have been broken before him. He's going to use, he's going to manipulate. He doesn't serve. Number two, in a broken world, physical resources will always be insufficient. That shouldn't surprise us. It does, but it shouldn't. There's not enough. Oh, really? Oh, really? Well, I mean, we got something, but it's like, okay, why don't we take that something and give it to God and see what God can do with it? Jesus, we got this fish story. It's this big. Let me give you what I got. And Jesus is going to take it and he'll break it. Be careful because he'll break it. But as he breaks it, you're going to find that his wisdom far outshines your own. And that thing that you thought you couldn't live without, he breaks and he hands back to you. And you have more than ever you could have hoped for. Number three, in a broken world, the sufficiency of God's kingdom is always manifested in brokenness. If you're on top of the world looking down on creation, be scared. Because you're only there for a little bit. Because in God's kingdom, his economy is to take his people and to allow them to be broken. That's why he says, take up your Lamborghini daily and follow. That's not what he says, right? He says, take up your cross daily and follow me. Because daily, brokenness is a daily reality for the people of God. And it's only in the brokenness of God's people that we minister out of our brokenness, out of our smallness, that God gets the glory. Because, face it, at the end of the day, if you ministered in your strength, what would you do? You'd rip off the jacket. Super disciple, right? We just do that. God takes us and he allows us to decrease so that he can increase. I don't know where the story strikes you today, but I hope it encourages you. Because your God has more than enough to suffice. He's given you a little, not to frustrate you, but to give you, to cause you to evaluate and take inventory and exercise faith. And he wants to take what little you have and he wants to bless others through you if you'll give it. Because this isn't primarily about you. He wants to feed others. He wants to draw others into his kingship. Will you let Jesus be the king that he is? Or are you holding on to the king that you want him to be? Because Jesus refuses to be the king that you're looking for. But all the while, he's teaching you to look for the king that he is. Will you bow your knees to Jesus for the king that he is, rather than trying to manipulate him to be the king you want him to be? Let's pray.